This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents High Risers, Cabrini Green and the Fate of American Public Housing by Ben Austin. Read by Ron Butler. Moving through the rubble and babble down the locked up, abandoned, ravished, sin-sacked and mildewed city, turning the cane about as if it were a symbolic key to the city given a visitor, a holy witness from another country come to save even you, and especially you. Nathaniel brooded now as they passed the government projects, adjacent to Rachel's house, and the fad-ridden Negro youths, harmonizing in a doorway, who apparently didn't know that their home was far over Jordan. Leon Forrest, The Bloodworth Orphans. It's not just buildings. It's not a place. It's a feeling. Since we all confess to be raised in Cabrini was a blessing, Cabrini is down but not out. Have no doubt. Cabrini is God's goods stretched out. Michael McLaren, Cabrini Green resident. Put the city up. Tear the city down. Put it up again. Let us find a city. Carl Sandburg, The Windy City. Part 1. A Home Over Jordan. 1. Portrait of a Chicago Slum. Tucked into the elbow where the river tacks north, just beyond the loop and a mile from Lake Michigan, it is as historic a neighborhood as there is in Chicago. In 2016, it was named one of the city's best places to live. A couple of generations earlier, and more than a century after the banks of the near north side were settled, surveyors from the Chicago Housing Authority walked its narrow streets, confirming with every step their belief that it was a slum beyond salvation. The field team from the CHA dodged trucks and trash heaps, careful lest they plunge into the open trenches dug for coal in front of the dwellings. The year was 1950, the quickening after the war, in the nation's second city, yet everything looked to be of the benighted past. Almost all the buildings dated to the previous century. Many of them were cheap frame constructions slapped up after the Great Fire of 1871, temporary emergency shelters turned permanent. In their notebooks, the surveyors tallied the area's deprivations. Nearly half of the 2,325 homes were without a bath or shower. Many had no private toilet, and all but a few relied on coal stoves for heat. Over the previous decade, the population in the 25 square blocks had swelled to 3,600 families, increasing by 50%. Yet only a single new residential building had been added. Flimsy partitions carved up the apartments into multiple units. "Excuse the appearance of this place," a housewife apologized as she welcomed the researchers into her subdivided home. "But we hardly have room to put ourselves someplace, and there just ain't room for anything else." Despite the conditions, rents had jumped by 70%. Landlords overcharged for their fire traps. The following year, the CHA issued its report, Cabrini Extension Area, Portrait of a Chicago Slum, which depicted in lurid detail the neighborhood the agency hoped to replace. Houses, black with age and weathered with soot, lean precariously, and their uneven roof lines form crazy quilt patterns against the sky. Chimneys tilt, eaves sag, rags stick out from broken windows, and doors without knobs stand open. There are few backyards. There can't be, when most of the lots contain two houses. Even the cover page sought to convey the ghetto in high squalor. A Trump loyal effect made the paper look burned and crumpled, as if found in one of the grubby alleys. The title was lettered in thick marker graffiti script, with a drawing of a cockroach scuttling past the second I in Cabrini. The employees of the Chicago Housing Authority in 1950 weren't paper-pushing functionaries. They were self-proclaimed liberal do-gooders, many of them coming to the agency from social work. Their portrait of the near North Side was meant to offend. They believed the slums of Chicago were killing people. House fires, infant mortality, pneumonia, tuberculosis, all occurred there at many times the rate found in the rest of the city. Poor housing conditions, the CHA noted, were contributing as well to high incidences of divorce, juvenile delinquency, and crime. The staff saw its work as a rescue mission. They needed to rid the city of blight. Houses work magic, their boss at the agency, Elizabeth Wood, would say. Give these people decent housing, and the better forces inside them have a chance to work. 99% will respond. Wood was an unlikely government official in the Chicago of the Democratic machine. She'd previously taught poetry at Vassar College and published a novel about an unhappily married woman who imparts her frustrations onto her children. A psychological study of merciless persecution, a reviewer wrote. She moved to Chicago to work for a welfare agency, but found the job ineffectual. She wanted to do more than scribble notes as desperate clients detailed their wants. When the CHA was formed in 1937, she took over as its executive director. Private enterprise had failed to provide the agency's minimal requirement of a decent, safe, and sanitary home for all. The Near North Side District was just one of the woeful examples that the CHA brandished as proof. Wood feared not that the city's new public housing projects might be too large, coming to define an area as low rent, but that they wouldn't be large enough to counteract the ravages of poverty and disrepair around them. If it is not bold, she said, the result will be a series of small projects, islands in a wilderness of slums beaten down by smoke, noise, and fumes. One of the islands Wood and her team hoped to expand was next to the Near North Side slum. In 1942, the CHA opened the Francis Cabrini Homes, 586 dwellings in barracks-style 2- and 3-story buildings. Federal rules established that public housing be built to minimum standards, using materials and designs unmistakably inferior to those found in market-rate housing. The Cabrini row houses were simple and unadorned, arranged in parallel columns like lines of parked tractor trailers. But in the neglected River District, they stood out as an oasis of order and modernity. Like a challenge to the existing decay, the CHA declared. Each of the Cabrini homes featured a gas stove, an electric refrigerator, a private bath, and its own heat controls. The buildings were made of fireproof brick, and the development was laid out so that parents could watch from their apartments as children played in communal courtyards. When you come upon one of Chicago's public housing developments, it is like stepping into a different world, the CHA rhapsodized in an early brochure. Everywhere you see green. Green of lawns, green of shrubbery, green of trees. Pleasant, vine-covered buildings stand in harmonious groups, with plenty of space left for sun and air and children's play. Everywhere you see gardens, and overhead stretches a sky that somehow looks bluer and sunnier than it did in the slums. The Near North Side was largely Italian for much of the first half of the 20th century, but a small black settlement formed there as well. The federal government restricted overseas immigration after the First World War, and so the factories along the river had vacancies they needed to fill. Most people also made great efforts to live far from the area's polluted work sites and ramshackle homes. Thus, African Americans were able to move in. That was an anomaly in segregated Chicago. As African Americans turned their back on the South, their population in Chicago more than doubled between 1910 and 1920, from 44,000 to 109,000, and then more than doubled again over the next decade, and again over the next 20 years, reaching 500,000 by 1950. Up until the 1940s, almost all of these newcomers moved to the South Side, in what was called the Black Belt, a broadening strip of land that extended south from the downtown business district. The Europeans who made a home along the Chicago River's North Fork were free to test the private market elsewhere, even if affordable options were scarce. During the 40s, the vacancy rate in the city fell to less than 1%, a total of 8,000 available units for the entirety of Chicago. But African Americans were forced to contend with a wholly separate real estate system. White neighborhoods established racial covenants, bylaws that barred homeowners from selling to African Americans. At one point, 85% of Chicago was covered under these restrictions. Even after the U.S. Supreme Court outlawed the practice in 1948, enforcement and legal recourse were negligible, and neighborhoods found less subtle means, such as assaults and firebombings, at least as effective. The federal government deemed existing black neighborhoods too risky for insured mortgages, coloring these areas red on its maps. Redlining meant African Americans could rarely purchase property in their own communities, except through predatory rent-to-own contract sales, in which buyers made inflated monthly payments but amassed no equity in the property. If or when they were evicted before the final payment, for any number of infractions, they lost the home, the down payment, and all the preceding monthly installments. After escaping the caprices of the Jim Crow South, drawn to Chicago by visions of a promised land, African Americans found themselves at the mercy of a speculative housing system in the North, unjust and unpredictable in its own rights. Landlords in black neighborhoods enjoyed both overwhelming demand for their properties and a captive market. They not only charged high rents for their run-down dwellings, but also divided existing apartments into numerous kitchenette units. The practice, while common throughout overcrowded Chicago, was epidemic in the Black Belt. Within the same square footage, the number of occupants and the amount of revenue increased exponentially. Cut a six-family walk up in half to house 12 families, into separate one-room apartments to make many more. There was no economic incentive for landlords to fix up their South Side properties. Redlining meant that banks wouldn't loan them money for the work anyway. With too many families crammed into airless wood-frame dwellings, forced to use alternative heating and cooking methods, with exposed wires and extension cords snaking in every direction from improvised walls and transoms to plug into the one or two overloaded circuits, fires were rampant. And because the kitchenettes were divided by nailed-up doorways and partitions that were themselves flammable, and because they lacked windows and safe exits, the fires too often proved deadly. "The kitchenette is our prison, our death sentence without a trial, the new form of mob violence that assaults not only the lone individual, but all of us in its ceaseless attacks," Richard Wright, who came to Chicago in 1927 from Mississippi by way of Memphis, lamented in his 12 Million Black Voices. "The kitchenette is the funnel through which our pulverized lives flow to ruin and death on the city pavement, at a profit." In the years following the Second World War, some 23 square miles of Chicago was said to be blighted, a tenth of the entire city. 250,000 homes, one-fourth of Chicago's total, were considered substandard. Chicagoans of all backgrounds were in need of the assistance of government-run public housing. But in the black slums of the South Side, the need was greatest. Due to his disadvantageous position in the present housing market, the Negro is the chief victim of excessive rents, the Cabrini Extension Area report concluded. Dolores Wilson, one of Wright's 12 million, a woman in her 20s who felt condemned to her South Side tenement, was a lifelong Chicagoan named Dolores Wilson. At the start of the 1950s, she and her husband, Hubert, were parents to 5 children, ages 8 to 1. 5 snotty-nosed kids running around, Dolores liked to say with feigned annoyance. The Wilsons had a one-room basement apartment on the 6,000 block of South Prairie Avenue, beside the grinding rattle of the L train and the trolley on 61st Street. The children slept on one side of the room, on a pull-out couch, and she and Hubert in a bed alongside the opposite wall. "With that arrangement," Dolores would say, "I'm not sure how the last child ever got made." The shower was propped up in the kitchen. The one window opened onto an alley. To use the toilet, they had to walk out their door and down the hallway, then past the laundry room to the bathroom the Wilsons shared with a family renting the backside of the partitioned basement. She never felt safe in that building. One night, while Hubert was at work, a man tried to break in through the window. "Oh, Lord!" Dolores cried while watching the guy struggle to shimmy his way inside, the children asleep not 6 feet away. She managed to take out a little pistol Hubert had left her and call the police, the phone trembling in one hand and the gun in the other. An officer who answered said she could go ahead and shoot the burglar, but only after he set foot in the apartment. Luckily, the man noticed her and took off. Dolores wasn't one to complain. Or rather, she had a way of doing it drolly, a genial-sounding protest, continuing all the while to make the best of a situation. She bought material from a 5 and dime and cut a red canopy for the mirror and the apartment's sole window. She found red dishes and a red checkered tablecloth to match, decorating the apartment the way she liked it. "It doesn't matter where you are," she liked to say. "It's after you put your fingerprint on it. Then it's your home." Dolores Wilson had such a pleasant-seeming brightness about her, her voice soft and high like a confection, that she'd laugh out of frustration or spite and then feel the need to explain that it wasn't intended to be a funny laugh. She called most people dear, though not infrequently she meant it wryly. "I try to get along with everybody, even the ones I don't get along with." She was careful to say, "Thank you, Father, for a roof over our heads." Everyone at least needed that. But it could feel like too much to cope with when the cold cut through the walls, or the structure meant to house your family might be killing them. The Chicago Defender, the city's leading black newspaper, kept count of the casualties from Southside house fires. "Negro children and women are dying like rats in fires and dilapidated homes unfit for human habitation. Homes that are in reality fire traps, which should have been condemned long ago by responsible officials," the paper wrote in one of many reports. Dolores often heard the sirens of the fire trucks. She knew that if her tenement went up in flames, they likely wouldn't make it out of the basement alive. The Wilsons had moved a few times within the confines of their neighborhood, but the other apartments were no better. Options for them were limited. Landlords told her she had too many children, or that children older than toddlers caused trouble. Dolores and Hubert paid $10 to a real estate agent who promised to provide them with a special list of quality apartments. Dolores traveled to each apartment the agent gave her, finding herself in front of yet another Southside fire trap. She double-checked that the address matched what she'd written down in her carefully looping script. The 6 flats before her listed to one side, with rotting wood or missing bricks. Inside, the floors drooped, the walls buckled, and the ceilings leaked. The plaster and paint crumbled about could poison her children. "Uh-uh," she'd say, backing away, as the smells of greens and other food cooking from a dozen kitchenettes assailed her. "It made me want to go in there and fix a plate, but I didn't want to move in," she'd say. "If their food is loud, you know all the noise they're going to make." $10 was a fortune to them. But after several of these trips, Dolores had to accept that they'd been had. Born Dolores Zanders in 1929 at Chicago's Cook County Hospital, she grew up on that same block of 6,000 South Prairie. Her mother's mother was an adventurer, a woman of means, who gave birth to each of her four children in a different state. Dolores's mother was originally from eastern Ohio, coal country, and she moved with her family to Chicago. Dolores's father followed her brother up north from Georgia. Her parents met in high school, and they settled into the apartment on Prairie as the block's last remaining Jewish family was set to depart. Dolores was one of their five children, and they lived well there. Dolores's mother worked as an assistant precinct captain for the local Democratic machine boss. Her father had a job as a presser and a tailor, even during the Depression years. He kept his pants pleated, his shoes polished to a high shine, and a satin banded hat cocked jauntily to one side. Dolores could hardly remember a time she saw him in work clothes. "He stayed immaculate, so sharp," she'd say. If she or her sisters noticed a piece of lint on his suit jacket, they knew to pick it off him. Dolores met Hubert when she was 14, soon after graduating from Betsy Ross Elementary. Her family usually went to a Baptist church across the street from their apartment, but occasionally they traveled four blocks west to the Uplifting of Humanity, a sanctified church led by her Aunt Rhea. Hubert was left-handed and sang in the choir, the dum-dum-dum of his bass drawing Dolores' gaze to him. When Hubert built up the nerve to phone and ask Dolores on a date, her parents said no. Dolores had almond-shaped eyes and a waggish intelligence, so he tried again. Her mother consented to an outing, but she calculated exactly how long it would take the two of them to travel by train to a movie theater downtown to see the coming attractions, a cartoon, and a double feature, and then return home. "No monkeying around," she ordered. "Go see that movie, get on the L, and come back." If they returned from a date just a couple of minutes late, Hubert wouldn't walk Dolores upstairs, choosing to be unmannerly rather than face her parents. Once when Hubert bought Dolores a sweater, her father made her give it back. He had a ban on gifts. A boy would expect sex in return. "You better not be having any sex," her mother added. "But if you are, make sure you use a rubber." Her parents made it clear that there was no greater moral failing than getting pregnant, forbidding Dolores from even socializing with girls believed to be fast. When Dolores' sister became pregnant, their father forced her into an unhappy marriage. Fearing her getting too serious, Dolores' parents didn't allow her to go steady with any one guy. Throughout high school, she dated not only Hubert, but also George, Clifford, Otis, Frank, and Beau. It was a short stroll from her apartment past South Parkway, which would later be renamed Martin Luther King Drive, and over to the expanse of Washington Park. She'd sit on the benches with her different boyfriends, or walk with them around the lagoon, or watch the games in the fields. Dolores loved her some Frank Jenkins, but she figured she loved Hubert more. Hubert looked older than the rest of them, even though he was the same age, and he could make Dolores laugh the way he told outlandish stories, his wit matching hers. People would say that the two of them together, with their banter, could have a comedy act on the radio. Hubert quit high school his junior year to help with his family's expenses. He was the type who'd do any sort of job, as long as it was legal. He shoveled coal into people's basements, cut ice from the lake, delivered refrigerators, laid tile. Dolores didn't realize how well off her family was until she and Hubert started swapping tales about the Depression. More than 40% of all working men in Chicago were unemployed during those years, and the city had a shortage of 150,000 affordable homes, with the demand increasing and nothing new being built. A Hooverville formed downtown, on the outskirts of Grant Park. Hundreds of jerry-built structures made of cardboard, scrap, and tar paper. Building construction may be at a standstill elsewhere, but down here, everything is booming. An out-of-work miner and railroad brakeman who'd been elected mayor of the shantytown told the press. On the south side, Dolores had her clothes dry-cleaned at her father's shop. And when her father was drafted into the Navy, her mother found work at a factory making aircraft. Hubert, on the other hand, had been eating neck bones cooked every kind of way. Fried, boiled, broiled, barbecued. His family had an apartment, a meager one, but they subsisted on the government charity boxes with "not to be sold" stamped on them. It was no surprise to Dolores that her father didn't think Hubert good enough for her. Always the dandy, her dad would stand in the wide window of their apartment, one shine shoe propped up on the sill, and at the sight of Hubert say, "Here comes Pete the Tramp," referring to the old comic strip. He turned it into a kind of mocking song as Hubert ambled up the block in his work clothes, a shovel hefted over his shoulder, a cigar stub tucked into the corner of his mouth, a dusting of coal on his hands and face. When Dolores was 18, in 1947, and enrolled at Woodrow Wilson Junior College, Hubert picked her up after classes. One day, when they reached Prairie Avenue, he wouldn't get out of the car. He stared silently into his lap, his chest heaving. He was sweating so much he looked to be melting. Then, with a dour expression, he asked Dolores if she would marry him. Now she couldn't breathe, feeling she might be having a heart attack. But soon they were both laughing, and quickly picked a date for the wedding and started hurtling ahead through the years, imagining the many milestones to come in their lives together. Then a thought paralyzed Dolores. Which one of them was going to tell her parents? "You are," he said. "Uh-uh, you." Dolores and Hubert Wilson, with their five children in a basement apartment, never considered leaving the South Side, let alone moving to the near North Side. They thought they had no options in the city other than the Black Belt, or maybe the West Side neighborhoods that had started filling with migrants from the South around the time they got married. And besides, the wilderness of slum around the Cabrini Row houses had its own notoriety in Chicago lore. As early as the middle of the 19th century, the settlement along the north branch of the Chicago River was as undesirable a place to call home as there was in the city. It teemed with dangerous and dirty jobs. Men hauled loads between barges and trains, worked in warehouses, tanneries, meatpacking plants, machine shops, and any number of small factories. The city's first ironworks was started along the river there, in 1857. By 1870, the North Chicago Rolling Mill employed 1,500 men, producing steel rails for the tracks that were steadily traversing the country. There was a massive gasworks on the riverbank a block from where the row houses would be built. An endless supply of coal fed into its hungry furnaces. While the resulting gas was stored in vats, the leftover tar and coke and other effluents flowed back into the mucky river. Black clouds of soot enveloped the neighborhood at all times, which is how the district came to be known as Smoky Hollow. The smell of sulfur was everywhere, too, and bright flames from the processed gas burst into the sky. And that's why it was also called Little Hell. It earned other nicknames as well, from the newly arrived immigrants who couldn't afford to live elsewhere. When the Irish landed there in the 1850s, the area became the Kilgubbin, named after the section of County Cork from which the refugees of the potato famine emerged. In 1865, it was one of the city's largest squatter villages, according to the Chicago Times, which wrote that the land numbered several years ago many thousand inhabitants, of all ages and habits, besides large droves of geese, goslings, pigs, and rats. It was a safe retreat for criminals, policemen not venturing to invade its precincts or even cross the border without having a strong reserve force. The local Irish referred to their new home sometimes simply as the Patch. Germans followed, working as small-scale farmers, peddling their produce out of wagons. Next came Swedes, who were even poorer than their predecessors, and their numbers were so great that they supported 8 different Swedish-language newspapers, and the nearby stretch of Chicago Avenue was dubbed the Swede Broadway. Then, in the first years of the next century, with alarming speed, the near north side turned into Little Sicily. Some 13,000 immigrants from towns in southern Italy rushed in to take over homes and storefronts from the besieged Irish, and the neighborhood quickly became the city's second largest Italian enclave. What distinguished this impoverished neighborhood above all else was its extraordinary proximity to Chicago's most expensive real estate. On the south side, the Black Belt became a world unto itself. But a mere 10 blocks east of Little Hell, beside the lakefront, sat the city's fanciest hotels and clubs, the high-end shops of Michigan Avenue, and the stately apartments bordered by tranquil streets of aristocratic single-family homes. One had to walk only a few minutes from this first-world opulence to enter the third-world meagerness along the river, with its garbage-laden alleyways, muddy lanes, and clotheslines crisscrossing overhead. The titans of industry and the city's philanthropists lived in the Gold Coast neighborhood along Lakeshore Drive. Little Sicily, less than a mile away, was where dark, shifty-eyed men with inscrutable faces lounge warily in the shadows of an areaway or in the murk of a corridor, as the local press reported in 1915. The sociologist Harvey Zorbaugh made the short physical distance between these urban extremes the subject of his 1929 book, The Gold Coast and the Slum, in which he portrays the River District's otherness as a pummeling of the senses. Dirty and narrow streets, alleys piled with refuse and alive with dogs and rats, goats hitched to carts, bleak tenements, the smoke of industry hanging in a haze, the market along the curb, foreign names on shops and foreign faces on the streets, the dissonant cry of the huckster and peddler, the clanging and rattling of railroads and the elevated, the pealing of the bells of the great Catholic churches, the music of marching bands and the crackling of fireworks on feast days, the occasional dull boom of a bomb or the bark of a revolver, the shouts of children at play in the street, a strange staccato speech, the taste of soot, and the smell of gas from the huge gas house by the river, whose belching flames make the skies lurid at night and long ago earned for the district the name Little Hell. On every hand one is met by sights and sounds and smells that are peculiar to this area, that are foreign and of the slum. The combination of poverty and proximity helped turn the near North Side ghetto into one of Chicago's major vice districts. The sensationalized coverage of the crimes committed there both exaggerated and contributed to the conditions. Zorbaugh describes the Italian neighborhood as a bizarre world of gang wars, of exploding stills, of radical plots, of lost girls, of suicides, of bombings, of murder. The intersection of what today is Oak Street and Cambridge Avenue, or possibly a block east at Oak and Cleveland, was shared by a cleaner's, a dyer's, a Jewish dry goods shop, and a Sicilian saloon that featured live music. It was also said to be the site of a dozen homicides a year for almost 2 decades. More than 100 unsolved murders were alleged to have occurred at what came to be known widely as Death Corner. The violence in Little Sicily was attributed to the Italian mafia, especially during Prohibition. but there was also a shadowy group known as the Black Hand. In 1908, a rumor spread that the Black Hand Society had placed a nitroglycerin bomb in the basement of Jenner Elementary, the school abutting Death Corner, which was set to detonate at 2 p.m. There was no bomb, but in a scene that would be replayed over the next century, students ignored their teachers and tumbled down the stairwells, trampling one another as mothers raced over from their cold water flats to rescue their children. In their elusiveness, the Black Hand assassins were depicted as phantasms, supernatural predators. Many of the neighborhood streets were elevated several feet above grade, and killers were said to lurk in the below-ground coal sheds and half-basements. In one brazen Death Corner murder recounted in the press, the culprits reportedly shot to death a man, waited for the police to arrive, and then, before slipping away unseen, shot the witnesses as they were giving their reports to the cops. Rumor had it that members of the Black Hand leaned over their victims and kissed them on the lips, to ensure that the ghosts of those they murdered wouldn't haunt them. In his first year as president, in 1933, Franklin Roosevelt created the Federal Housing Division as part of the Public Works Administration. By then, the shortcomings of the for-profit real estate market were evident in mass evictions and eviction riots, in homeless encampments, and in countless neighborhoods like Little Sicily. "I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished," Roosevelt announced in 1937 in his second inaugural address. "The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little." In the face of what looked like a humanitarian crisis, and with decades of shaming and lobbying by progressive slum reformers and proponents of modernized housing, the government mobilized its resources. The PWA built 51 public housing developments over the next 4 years, including three in Chicago. In 1937, after 2 years of wrangling over the particulars, Congress passed more extensive legislation that established a federal housing agency. Chicago and other cities formed their own housing authorities to operate the subsidy locally. The CHA, under Elizabeth Wood's leadership, picked sites for new public housing developments, and the infamy of Little Hell made it an obvious choice. When the Francis Cabrini row houses were completed in 1942, hundreds of federal, state, and city officials attended the dedication ceremonies on Chestnut Street and Cambridge Avenue. Mayor Edward Kelly, his red hair like slag in a sea of Mediterranean complexions, as one reporter recounted, announced that the 586 units of public housing symbolize the Chicago that is to be. "We cannot continue as a nation half slum and half palace. This project sets an example for the wide reconstruction of substandard areas which will come after the war." Father Luigi Giambastiani of St. Philip Benizi Parish, located next to Death Corner, was among the leaders of the neighborhood Sicilian community to suggest that the row houses be named for Mother Francesca Cabrini. A nun who settled in the United States in 1889 and worked among the Italian poor, Mother Cabrini established a school and a hospital in Chicago, as well as more than 60 institutions countrywide. She died in Chicago in 1917. "To you, she is a social worker," Father Giambastiani told the press. "But to us, she is a saint." In 1946, Rome would agree. Mother Cabrini became the first American citizen to be canonized, the patron saint of immigrants. Working families with young dependents were initially given preference for admission into the planned Cabrini row houses, since they were often rebuffed in the open market. To secure a coveted spot, married couples had to pass rigorous screening and earn enough annually to meet minimum rent requirements. Very poor families, those who were unemployed, unstable, or unseemly, The new public housing wasn't intended for them. The subsidy wasn't charity or humanitarian assistance. The developments were supposed to revitalize the slums, not replicate them. Days before construction on the Cabrini row houses was to get underway, however, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Many of the factories in and around Little Sicily were converted to war-related industries. Amid the city's affordable housing shortage, the CHA agreed to give families of veterans and war workers priority in the new development. In exchange, the agency was able to secure rationed building supplies and proceed with construction. The renters would pay between $24 and $37 a month for a three-bedroom home, based on their income, with electricity, hot water, and heating fuel included. But to accommodate war workers with their higher salaries, the CHA more than doubled the maximum amount that residents could earn yearly and still qualify for a unit, from $900 to $2,100. This at a time when a third of all Chicago families, and just about everyone in Little Hell, had an annual salary of less than $1,000. They would likely not find a home in this Chicago that is to be. Dolores Wilson. Before Dolores and Hubert were married, Hubert was picked up by the police. He was accused of robbing a cleaner's on his South Side block. His family assured the police that he'd been at home with them, but a neighbor fingered him as the thief, saying she thought the guy she may have seen in the dark alley three stories below looked sort of like Hubert. That was enough for the cops. They moved him from one precinct house to another so his relatives couldn't find him. At one of the police stations, officers handcuffed his wrists to the arms of a chair, demanding that he confess to the crime he didn't commit. When he refused, two white cops standing on either side of him counted down, and at the same moment, each one bashed an ear. The headaches from that beating lasted for the next 30 years of Hubert's life. Sometimes Dolores would think about all the pain that the police caused folks, how Chicago cops abused their power, especially in the city's black neighborhoods, and she'd shake with contempt, losing her ability to speak. There was a black officer in their neighborhood named Sylvester Washington. Though everyone called him Two-Gun Pete, for the pair of pearl-handled .357 Magnum revolvers he wore around his belt like an old West gunslinger. Once, when Dolores had taken a group of children to the Bud Billiken Parade, an annual event in the South Side sponsored by the Defender, she lined them up to buy ice cream. Two-Gun Pete pushed over the little boy at the front of the line, for no other reason than to see the children topple in a row like dominoes. One night, Hubert was on his way home, wearing sunglasses, when Two-Gun stopped him. "Is the moon too bright for you?" the cop demanded. He smacked the glasses off of Hubert's face and ordered him to pick them up. When Hubert bent over, Two-Gun kicked him in the back. Then the cop slapped the shades off Hubert's face again and told him to get them. The police officer had, officially, killed 9 people while on duty. And the department, rather than punishing Two-Gun, rewarded him with promotions. Hubert knew what was coming, but he didn't want to add to Two-Gun's body count. The kick sent him to the ground. With Hubert locked up for the cleaner's robbery, his family hired a lawyer, and that put an end to the railroading between holding cells. Dolores baked biscuits and sent them to the jail. As Hubert bit into each one, he'd find tiny pieces of paper stuck to his tongue, notes that read, "I love you." It turned out that it was Beau, one of Dolores's other suitors, who'd broken into the cleaners. He was arrested, and Hubert was cleared of the crime. The couple named their first child after Hubert, but people called little Hubert Chuckaluck as a baby, and when he took his first steps, Dolores's brother cried, "Che-Che." And that's the name that stuck. Then came Michael, Debbie, Cheryl, and Kenny. Two of them were born in their apartment, with a county doctor showing up only after the delivery to cut the cord. Dolores and Hubert wanted better for their growing family than their basement apartment, so they tried to purchase a home. They learned about a subdivision soon to be built on the distant south side. It was being constructed from the ground up, on empty land. With the help of Dolores's aunt, they made the down payment for the house that existed only as an architectural plan. Dolores's sister and sister-in-law and their families also bought into the same development. They each picked out their plots, and in their anticipation, they talked endlessly together about what the houses would look like. How do you walk through the front door and step down to enter the living room, like in a television program? Then Hubert came down with the Asian flu. He was working in construction, and for 2 days he couldn't lift himself out of bed. On the third day, before the fever broke, he forced himself to return to the job, but it was too late. His boss fired him. The Wilsons fell behind on their payments and eventually lost the property. Dolores' sister and sister-in-law soon pulled out, too. Losing the down payment didn't bother Dolores too much, since she never got overly excited about money. But losing the dream of the thing hurt. She'd eventually shrug and say about the flu that ended their chance at owning a home, "How come some other part of the world always gotta mess you up?" The question for Dolores wasn't whether she wanted to move into public housing, but which of the new developments would take her. "Public housing was my best bet for my children," she'd say. There weren't any vacancies in the Ida B. Wells homes, a Southside complex that had been built exclusively for black residents. When the Wells homes were completed in 1941, 18,000 families applied for the 1,662 units. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt visited, and the opening was cause for a parade, with marchers waving placards declaring, "Better housing, better health, better citizens." Dolores filled out a CHA application at a church on 47th Street, in the Bronzeville neighborhood, and a social worker asked for documentation showing that she was married and that Hubert had a job. "You had to prove everything," Dolores would recall. The interview covered their rental and work history, Che-Che's grades, and the family's values. Another person from the agency visited their apartment to see how Dolores kept house. She had no idea what they wrote down in their notebooks. She cared only that she passed the test. The elaborate screening worked as a kind of validation. They, among the city's hordes of working poor, had proven worthy of elevation. In the new developments, the CHA awarded prizes for the best gardens and issued fines for littering. A spot in public housing felt like a leap into the middle class. She first thought she might try for Altgeld Gardens, on the far south side. It was built during the war, 130 blocks from the Loop, so that African Americans could work in the nearby steel mills along Lake Calumet. With its 1,500 homes on 157 acres of formerly vacant land, Altgeld was like a self-contained, all-black village. The public housing development was so large and isolated that it had its own on-site Board of Health clinic, library, and church, its own grocery and drug store, its own nursery, elementary, and high schools. One of Dolores's aunts lived there, in a compact box of a row home with a little upstairs and downstairs, a tiny front lawn, and a backyard. Her aunt loved it, and Dolores was drawn to the idea of tending her own garden. In her basement apartment on Prairie Avenue, they hardly got any light at all, and she didn't dare open the window too wide for fear of what might blow in from the alley. But Dolores couldn't get over how remote Altgeld felt. It was basically in Indiana. It didn't connect to streetcars or trains, and the bus service was spotty. "When I'm ready to go somewhere, I don't want to have to wait for a scheduled bus that might not be there for an hour," she'd say. That's when she looked at Cabrini. After its 1950 survey of the Cabrini extension area, the CHA raised the slum alongside the row houses, demolishing the 2,325 units of substandard housing there. In their place, the agency erected 15 separate towers that stood 7, 10, and 19 stories tall, a total of 1,925 apartments. The original plans called for 16 buildings, with the tallest of them reaching only 9 and 16 stories. But to further cut down on costs, the extra floors were added, and an entire building eliminated. The nearly identical designs of the high-rises added to the speed and inexpensiveness of the construction. The towers were stripped-down modernist plinths, with row after row of windows. Constructed of wine-colored bricks set inside a latticed frame of exposed white concrete, they had the look of graph paper, with repeating red boxes outlined in white. Because of the brick color, the 15 high-rises came to be known locally as the Reds. Although the high-rises resulted in a net loss to the area of 400 units of housing, the complex was prized for using just 13% of the 35-acre site. The towers were ringed by vast plazas and lawns. Builders trucked in 25,000 cubic yards of topsoil. They planted 10,000 bushes and 500 trees, and protected it all with 23,000 square feet of chain-link fencing. The several square blocks between Chicago Avenue and Division Street were closed off to through streets and reformed into a massive, pedestrian-only superblock, with no businesses, street traffic, or other uses apart from housing, a school, and a community center. It was a purity of modernist city planning, influenced by the avant-garde Towers in the Park urban reimagining of the Swiss-French architect Le Corbusier. When all 15 of the towers were fully operational in 1958, the Cabrini extension was Chicago's largest public housing high-rise complex, a template for the many others to come.
"We thought we were playing God in those days," says Lawrence Amstutter, one of the development's architects.
"We were moving people out of some of the worst housing imaginable, and we were putting them into something truly decent. We thought we were doing a great thing, doing a lot of innovative design things."
A handbill for the new development was written as if speaking directly to Dolores. "For families for whom private enterprise has not been able to build or operate decent, safe, and sanitary dwellings at prices within low-income budgets, just a mile or 10 minutes by streetcar from the Loop." It was close to near Northside parks and beaches, handy to swimming and fishing in Lake Michigan, and down the street from Montgomery Ward's big retail store. The Larrabee Street bus offered a straight shot into downtown. You could walk to 100 different factories to find work. The Cabrini extension towers weren't designed with interior hallways. Rather, each floor included an open-air gallery. "Sidewalks in the air," Elizabeth Wood called these exposed ramps. In a high-rise with hundreds of apartments, each family could have ready access to the out-of-doors, the CHA pointed out. An open porch on the 19th floor is a convenient play space for small children under mother's watchful eyes. It adds zest to living in the new home for families who formerly had to come out of basements to see daylight. And the CHA promised that the addition of nearly 2,000 units of public housing to the 600 that already existed in the row houses would be a boon to the long-neglected area. More public housing meant more modern construction, more retail, more amenities and services. The CHA advertised that the tall apartment towers would blend with the row house and garden apartments of present Cabrini, declaring, "2,500 families and housing easy to make into good homes will change the whole neighborhood." Everyone in Dolores' family lived on the south side, but the idea of life at Cabrini grabbed a hold of her.
"Near north, near everything," she recited like a hymn.
2. The Reds and the Whites. Dolores Wilson. The Wilsons were one of the first families, in 1956, to move into their 19-story Cabrini Extension high-rise, They were assigned an apartment on the 14th floor, and everything smelled of fresh paint. Dolores had never been that high in the sky before. She forced herself to the edge of their sidewalk in the air, the walkway outside the apartment, and clutched the chest-high fencing as she peered down. The cars looked no bigger than toys. "I almost fainted," she would recall. That was the first day. Then after a while you grow used to everything. Soon she was delighting in her lordly view of Chicago's rippled skyline and the blue-gray blur of the lake disappearing into the horizon. Just as the CHA had advertised, she stretched out on what they called the ramp, enjoying the breeze while her children played alongside her. Flies and mosquitoes didn't reach 14 stories, nor did all the sounds of the street. She started to feel sorry for her neighbors who filled the apartments on the floors below. Like all the new Cabrini Towers, the Wilsons building was known impersonally by its address, 1117 North Cleveland, which was painted in a somber, blocky script above the front entrance. The architect, Lawrence Amstetter, had wanted to install metal numerals and letters, explaining that it would actually cost less to do so. But he was told the metal gave off the appearance of being pricier. Public housing was considered charity, he said. It had to look economical. The entitlement had the tricky task of ensuring that those with too little received only just enough. That was fine by Dolores. It was the projects, she'd say, by which she meant it was clean and safe and spectacular to behold. They now had 5 full rooms, with a large living room, a kitchen, and their own private bathroom. She and Hubert slept in one bedroom, the boys in another, and the girls in a third. There was a fridge, a stove, and hot and cold water. The walls were plumb, the floors and ceilings unbreached. Her mother would phone when the temperature dropped into the teens, worried that Dolores might be inside the apartment barefoot. Dolores would hush Hubert as he shouted from the other room that she didn't have on any shoes. But this wasn't a South Side tenement. The heat in their building pulsed through the floors and enveloped them. Outside, the frigid air rolling in off the lake or the prairies blasted the high-rise. But inside, the temperature exceeded 80 degrees. On the most penetrating winter days, with ice layering on the ramps and the wind roaring like a jet engine, Dolores still cracked her window, and they paid just a small fixed amount for utilities and a monthly rent that was based on their annual income. The interior walls, too, were solid cinder block. If a fire broke out in any kitchen in the building, the flames couldn't go any further than that apartment. Dolores would demonstrate by entering each room and shutting the door. It was fireproof, she would say. The whole thing was fireproof. Even the smoke couldn't get in there. It was like heaven. The comparison turned out to be a common one. Something as elemental as a modest home seemed divine after the damnation of its absence. "It's heaven here," a different mother who moved into one of the other newly built red Cabrini high-rises told the press. "We used to live in a 3-room basement with 4 kids. It was dark, damp, and cold." J.S. First, one of Elizabeth Wood's do-gooders at the CHA, headed up the agency's research and statistics division, and had overseen the 1950 survey of the Cabrini Extension area. For a book of interviews he titled When Public Housing Was Paradise, First collected dozens of similar testimonials from early occupants of Chicago's public housing. "It's almost like I died and went to heaven," one tenant said about moving into a low-rise development. "We felt it was just paradise," another resident told him. "We felt this was just the greatest housing that we could live in." In Dolores' basement apartment on Prairie, if the shared toilet didn't flush or a circuit shorted, she could call her landlord. But he might just as soon put them out as fix the place. At Cabrini, the government owned her home. there was a city agency responsible for answering her requests. Her building had a team of janitors on call around the clock. Groundskeeper